in these words that I say, I'll close my eyes to everyone but you. And when I do, I'll see you standing there, lock my heart to any other caress. I'll never say yes to a new love affair. Then I'll close my eyes everything that's gay. If you are not there, ah, to share each lovely day, and through the years, and those moments when we're far apart, don't you know I'll close my eyes and I'll see you with my heart.
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit kuci.org or kucitalk.org.
And hello and welcome again to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus. We're also on the web at kuci.org, and you can find us on iTunes. Go to Radio Public and click on KUCI FM. We're right there. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Writers on Writing features authors, editors, poets, literary agents, and all sorts of folks involved in publishing. And that's the reason we're here, to talk about books and writing and publishing. Today my guest is Dennis McDougall. His new book is called Five Easy Decades: How Jack Nicholson Became the Biggest Movie Star in Modern Times, published by Wiley. He writes for the New York Times. He's a former Los Angeles Times staff writer. He's won more than 40 awards for his coverage of the entertainment industry. He was on before for The Last Mogul, Lou Wasserman, MCA. And I've known Dennis a long time. It's great to have him on. Hi, Dennis.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm all right. How are you?
Well, last time I checked, I still had a pulse. It's always a good sign.
Oh, my goodness. You continue to be prolific, and you have reasons for this. But before we get to the writing process and the writing of biographies, talk about Five Easy Decades and how this one came about.
Oh, well, actually, it is a little different than a number of my previous books. I mean, most of my previous books were the result of coming up with the idea, developing a book proposal, and shopping it to publishers in New York. But in this particular instance, I had written a proposal for a book on Edgar Bronfman Jr., a biography of the heir to the Seagram's liquor fortune, And I had, I had several possibilities, but ultimately no cigar on that one. One of the publishers that was interested in the Bronfman book and then ultimately did not make an offer was John Wiley and Sons, which is, I think, if I'm not mistaken, America's oldest continuous book publisher. They're 200 years old as of this year. And I struck up a relationship with the acquisitions editor there, Eric Nelson. He liked me, and he wanted to work with me. And he came up with several topics or several subjects for biographies and asked if I would be interested in doing any of them. The only two that really interested me were Mel Brooks and Jack Nicholson. And I nixed Mel Brooks for my own reasons. I felt like he was interesting, but probably not not interesting enough in terms of for commercial purposes. And Jack Nicholson, I nixed on grounds that he'd been done to death. There had already been a half dozen biographies published about him. But Eric said, well, what we're interested in is something different. We don't want to do just a straight biography of Nicholson. It would be from the point of view of how his life and his career reflect the changes in Hollywood over the past 50 years. And that, that simple twist on the old idea really struck me as being interesting because Nicholson is unique in that way. He's one of the few actors, film actors, turned movie star, who has sustained a career and a level of interest over half a century, which is pretty stunning. It's an incredible achievement when you stop and think about it. I mean, the guy is 70 years old this year. He'll soon be 71. And for, you know, most of his life, he has been an icon. He's now the elder statesman of Hollywood. And whenever anyone thinks of Jack Nicholson, they automatically think of the film industry. So, with that as a premise, I did start the basic research and spent a lot of time, a lot of hours at the Academy Library, and I went ahead and gave the nod to Eric Nelson, and he got me a nice advance, and I spent what, 3 years researching and writing the life story of Jack Nicholson, and as it turns out, the history of the evolution of Hollywood from the end of the studio era in the 1950s to the present day. That, you know, really had resonance with me because that's what I try to do with biographies. I don't want to just sit down and say so-and-so was born at the age of three as smart as he could be. It's far more intriguing and satisfying for me as a writer and a student of human nature to look at an individual in the context of the industry that they represent. I don't know if that's a long-winded way of answering your question, but hey, you know, you asked.
Hey, we like long-windedness on this show, actually. Seriously, I like the depth to which you go. And I wonder though, with the research, how much research do you do before you actually start writing? Or are you creating an outline as you're researching, or you know, are you seeing what you find out? How does your research direct the project? Or does it?
Oh boy. Well, it's the kinds of projects that I do, research is everything, because that's where the nuggets are. That's where the anecdotes are. That's where the building blocks of the story are. You have to spend enormous swaths of time traipsing through archives and unpublished manuscripts and troves of letters and hanging out in libraries and finding obscure libraries that people don't even know about. I remember when I was doing the Otis Chandler book. I came across a library that was down in your neck of the woods that most people don't even know exists, and it turned out to be a treasure trove for looking into the early history of Los Angeles and the Chandler family in general. You know, the Chandlers were the publishers of the Los Angeles Times for close to 100 years before it began to fall in hard times, and the book that resulted from my researches was A Privileged Son, Otis Chandler and the Rise and Fall of the L.A. Times Dynasty.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a little library right around the corner from where you live called the Sherman Gardens.
Yeah.
You know, and everybody knows it for the gardens, which are, you know, magnificent in and of themselves. But tucked in the back of the gardens is a dusty old archive and library that contains volumes that date back to the 19th century. You can't find any place else. There's a whole section that's Spanish language history of Baja California, and it's all there for anybody to go in and look at, but nobody does because nobody even is aware that it's there. I found that to be true throughout the research that I did for that book. There are several such libraries in and around Los Angeles that have great stuff, great stories. So research is everything to me. The degree to which I commit myself to research before I actually write, especially before I write the proposal, that's a whole different question. I want to find out, first of all, if there's enough there to sustain a book. And a book is not just a catalog of events. A book has to have a narrative. And the narrative has to things have come under fire just recently here in terms of fiction versus nonfiction. So I hesitate to say that the narrative has to be fiction-like or has to have the same elements that go into a novel. But I'm a strong believer in the so-called new journalism of the 60s and 70s. The journalism of Gay Talese and Tom Wolfe and Truman Capote, and that's sort of been my model throughout most of my career. And that kind of narrative doesn't work unless you really get down to cases in terms of research and really dig and find out exactly how something comes about. You have to always avoid embellishing or making things up. Otherwise, you get into big trouble. But then I've never been tempted to write a memoir about South Central Los Angeles, so I guess I'll never be face that kind of a problem. I'm dealing with this right now, Barbara, in terms of my next book. I'm pretty sure that I will at least get to the proposal stage on a book about the Getty Museum. And I've been spending a lot of time. In fact, I'm in Southern California now, concentrating on just that, the basic research surrounding the Getty Museum and its various scandals over the past 30 years. But I know that, you know, all I will do is scratch the surface, because once you make a commitment to a project like this, you're talking about a 2 to 3 year slog, and the things that you find along the way sometimes make the initial research look pretty drab in comparison. But the process is such that you have to sell the book first with lots of sizzle, and then that gives you the time and money that you need to look even deeper.
You are listening to Writers on Writing. I'm with Dennis McDougall. His new book is Five Easy Decades, How Jack Nicholson Became the Biggest Movie Star in Modern Times by Wiley. The research points you in the direction of story, narrative, and you're looking for a story so that, like you just said, it's obviously not fiction, but I think good biographies, good memoirs have the structure of story, so that it's not just a listing of details and facts and all of that. So do you know where you're going to end up, or do you have some idea and then you go for the ride, you write the book, and you end up where you thought you were going to end up, or you end up somewhere else? With this book, were there surprises along the way that pointed you in a different direction?
Oh, sure. Well, with Five Easy Decades, I mean, there remain questions that I feel need to be answered, and I'm still making discoveries after the fact. I mean, you know, one of the things that I'm in this interesting period between the publication of the hardback and the publication of the paperback, and you get feedback from people after the fact, and you go, well, darn it, why didn't you come to me in the first place? You know, I could have included it in the original edition. And, you know, little factoids and things that fill in the gaps. And you wind up having to, do an afterword and add additional information in the paperback edition, which is, it's okay. I mean, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. In fact, it can be quite revealing, as in the afterword to the Last Mogul, I was able to add some news and notes that I didn't have in the original edition. I don't know. I find it it's you can't find out everything, you know, especially at the book proposal stage. You're only going to hit the you're only going to hit the high notes. And the short answer to your question is yes, the finished product almost invariably does not match precisely what you proposed in the original book proposal. It can't, because you're writing and researching over time, and things change. What was true today might not be 2 years from now when the book is actually published. It can be a problem, but it can also add heft and resonance to the finished product. The book does not always turn out. You know, it's interesting to go through the little exercise of going back and looking at your original cell proposal and comparing that to what you ultimately turn into to the publisher. It's always just a little bit different, sometimes a lot different. But the Nicholson book was came closer to being what I originally envisioned than probably most of my other previous books. He turns out to be the proverbial enigma wrapped in a riddle that I thought that he was, and it's the way that he is. It's the way that he likes it. But I think that he also reveals himself in his actions, and that's reflected in the pages of Five Easy Decades.
Now, do you? You've done a bunch of biographies. You've done true crime. Do you have to, as far as biography goes, do you have to really like your subject? I mean, did you like Lou Wasserman? Did you like Otis Chandler? Obviously, you are a fan of Jack Nicholson's, but I mean, is that a prerequisite in doing a book project, or do you have to simply be curious about them and their life?
No, I don't think you have to like somebody to write their biography. I think you have to be intrigued with them. I mean, you have to be, and you can't just be momentarily intrigued with them. It can't be a flash in the pan. You can't say, gee, I really like that song that you sang, and therefore I want to write your life story. I suppose it helps in some ways to really like the person that you're writing about. That sustains you over the 2 year or 3 year slog that it takes to get the book done. And as you know, writing is rewriting. You know, all the novices out there think that you sit down and you just bang it out, and that that's all there is to it. But the reason that it takes so long is that you're constantly rewriting and revising, and sometimes, you know, you throw out whole sections and start all over again. And in order to do that, in order to keep your interest to a level that you're not throwing up your hands and just saying, what's the use? You do either have to really like the person that you're writing about, or at the very least, you have to really like the idea that you're writing about. In the case of Lou Wasserman, obviously, I was not a big fan of Lou Wasserman, but I was... from beginning to the end of the book, I was fascinated. I continue to be fascinated by this guy and what he was able to do with his life. I mean, he became the major single player in the motion picture industry for close to half a century. In a sense, you know, the Five Easy Decades picks up where The Last Mogul leaves off, which, you know, if you read those two books back to back, if you read The Last Mogul and Five Easy Decades, you'd have the entire history of Hollywood.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, literally from the very beginning in the teens in the 1920s when Jules Stein first made his way from Chicago to Beverly Hills, all the way down to the present day when Jack Nicholson attended his 50th high school reunion in Neptune, New Jersey, climaxing a portion of his life. So I don't think you have to like the person that you're writing about, but you have to be fascinated with what it was that they accomplished.
Mm-hmm. We're going to take a break. Give you a chance to take a sip of water, do a station identification. All of you out there, stay with us. We'll be back in just a few with more Dennis McDougall and Five Easy Decades. Don't go away.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. Gone 24 hours, child, seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. Darling, one month better than a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
We're back with more Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM, broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and on the web at KUCI.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and we've been here with Dennis McDougall from the start of the hour, and we're going to continue on with him. First, let me say that if you missed the first half of the show or you want to direct friends to the show, it will be podcast in another week or so. If you go to my website, which is penonfire.com, click on the radio tower on the left side of the screen, you will see the radio page, and at the top of which is directions, will be directions to listen to the podcast. They're up 24/7, maybe 300 shows we have up at this point, thanks to podcast guru Rob Roy. And this one will join them. So check out the podcast, and let's bring Dennis back on. Hello again.
Hello.
Hello. You know, what I want to talk about for a minute is something that I've been thinking about since, I don't know, a couple of weeks ago. Somehow I ran into somebody who was talking about biographies, and she said, and it wasn't about yours, it was just about biographies, and she said, You know, I don't trust biographies because I always wonder what all the writer left out, and I feel like I'm not getting the entire truth. And I thought that was interesting. And I said, well, but, you know, unauthorized biographies, you know, it's really, you know, the writer isn't leaving anything out to please the subject. They're, you know, deciding what works best and what needs to stay and what needs to go. And she said, yeah, but I still don't trust him. So my question is then, what do you keep and leave out? I mean, if you're trying to, with an unauthorized biography as yours, you're not writing it to please your subject. You're writing it really, I would think, to please yourself and to feel that you've written the story you meant to write. So what would you say to someone like her? In a polite something, what would you say?
Well, you know, a biography is not everybody's cup of tea. I mean, it sounds to me like your friend probably doesn't read them to begin with. I mean, there is an audience out there for biographies, but her preference is probably something else, something other than biography. It sounds to me like, you know, she has a built-in prejudice, and I don't mean that in a negative or a pejorative way, but she feels as though, by definition, if somebody writes about somebody else, they're not going to be telling the whole truth. But then, that's just a fact. I mean, that's just a fact about everything, not just biographies. I mean, if you read about somebody in the daily newspaper, or you read a magazine article about somebody, if you see a biography on television, if you go to a movie and you see a biopic, you're not going to get the whole truth. I mean, you're not going to get the whole picture. How do you encompass the story of an individual, any individual, the entire story of an individual, and put it on paper? I mean, by definition, that's impossible because nobody knows what goes on between the two ears of a human being. They may have a life that you know nothing about. And even if you came in with the intention of telling absolutely everything about that person, you just couldn't. I mean, you know, it's not possible. So, that said, what a biographer, in my estimation, ought to do is bring his or her point of view to a life, to the life of an individual, to the subject that they're writing about. And it would be true of an institution a place just as much as it would be true of a human being. You always bring your point of view. You always do. And when you bring your point of view, you can be criticized for leaving out some information and emphasizing too much other information. And I think that's probably what your friend is really talking about. I mean, I suspect that that's what her criticism is, because it's true. She's right, you know. I mean, a biography doesn't tell you everything. Couldn't. So what I do as a biographer is I do bring my sensibility, my interests, my worldview to the subject I'm writing about. That doesn't mean I discount who they are and only put down my opinion. But I do concentrate on those aspects of an individual's life and family and impact or lack thereof on the culture as I see it. And I think that that's a responsible way to pursue the craft.
Mm-hmm. Talk about how you found your way to writing biographies, because you have quite a few true crime books out as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm so curious how you went from true crime to biography, and if there are still true crime narratives you're interested in pursuing.
Well, you know, I mean, sure. I mean, crime has always. I've always had an interest in crime and abstruse human psychology. I studied it for a year on a fellowship at Stanford back in the 80s, psychology and law. It's always been one of my overriding interests. I still don't have the answer after all these years, but I've always been intrigued as to why and how it is that that a human being, you know, someone could do such horrible things to another human being, or in the case of some of the people I've written about, a whole slew of human beings. You know, my first book was about Randy Kraft, who, as probably a good many of your listeners in Orange County know,
mm-hmm.
Was probably the most prolific serial killer in U.S. history. And he was an Orange County boy, born and bred in beautiful downtown Westminster when it wasn't so, when it was all farmland back in the 40s. I'm reminded, when it comes to, you know, my fascination with true crime, I'm reminded of that great scene from Annie Hall, where you know, the Woody Allen's character is in elementary school, and he just simply lines up all of these cute kids who are, I don't know, you know, in first or second grade. and does this this series of little vignettes where each of them talk about who they are when they grow up. You know, there's like the cute little girl who says, "I'm now a hooker," and and the little boy who says, "Yes, I grew up to be a serial killer." And you know, and you go, well, how is that possible? I mean, if you pursue that comic question to its end, therein lies the wellspring of a true crime writer's interest in writing those stories. How is it that a cute little kid, you know, grows up to be a monster? And I still have that interest. I still want to know why. Why a person goes off the deep end and commits horrible crimes. Will I write another true crime book? You know, I mean, I'm sort of toying with that idea right now. I came across a 40-year-old murder that the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Office cold case unit is looking at again, and I may actually take that up. I've been out to talk to the family and the victims, survivors, and read some of the case file on it. I might do that. I don't know, but I haven't abandoned the genre completely. In fact, you know, the book I did before, the last book I did before the Jack book was the Robert Blake murder story.
Mm-hmm. And did that come about through your own doing, or were you asked to do it, or how do your books basically come about? I mean, you've talked about biographies. What about the true crime?
In the case of the Robert Blake book, myself and another reporter had been assigned, we'd basically been given a blank check by TV Guide in its dying days as a major circulation magazine, just to go out and get to the bottom of the case for the magazine. So, you know, we took off and spent some time in Memphis and spent some time in San Francisco and went and interviewed Bonnie Bakley. She was the murder victim and Blake's wife at the time, and interviewed her relatives in New Jersey. And we came back and produced a very long story for TV Guide. It was like close to 20,000 words when we got finished, and it was boiled down to maybe half that for the magazine. But it was in researching that magazine piece that we thought that, yeah, there might be a book here. And I contacted my agent, and she very quickly cinched a deal, and we produced that book pretty quickly before the trial took place, and that's how that happened. It evolved out of a lengthy magazine piece. There's a lot of books that that happen that way, but you know, not always, I suppose. I mean, the previous true crime book that I did, the Yosemite murders, was evolved out of a one-page fax that I sent to Ballantine Books. And I had worked with the editor previously on another book, and she was very enthusiastic and got me a deal the same week, just based on the fax. So, you know, you never know. I've sold a book on a 60-page proposal, and I've sold a book on a phone call and a one-page fax. It all depends on, more than anything else, that that elusive element of timing.
Mm-hmm.
There's no way of knowing. There's really no way of second guessing that. I told you earlier in the program about the Bronfman proposal, and you know, I got universal kudos from the acquisition editors who saw it in New York, but no takers.
Mm-hmm.
Well, a year passes and some Canadian writer got a deal with a Toronto publisher and wrote the book. So he wrote a biography of Bronfman, and I read that news and dashed off an email to my agent saying what the heck happened here, and she fired back a single word reply. Timing,
yeah. Hmm. You're listening to Writers on Writing. We have a few minutes left with Dennis McDougall, whose most recent book is Five Easy Decades, published by Wiley. And I want to tell you as well, there's lots of info on his website, which is DennisMcDougall.com. Lots of info, a fun journal, with lots of stuff, and just, it's a great one. So check out his website. Are you ever worried with true crime about lawsuits? I ask that because I recall Joe Wambaugh saying that the only true crime books he never got sued over, it was only one. I think it was called The Blooding, that was, that took place in England, because the laws are different there. You know, whoever loses has to pay the bills. Mm-hmm. And that's the only one, he said, that he, has gotten sued over everyone. He's never lost one, but he's spent so much money on lawsuits. Has that happened with you, or do you worry about that?
Well, I've only been sued once in my entire life, and that was by Randy Kraft. Randy Kraft sued me from his cell on death row in San Quentin after the publication of Angel of Darkness, on grounds that I had libeled his good name. of course, the suit was, once it got before a judge, it was tossed out in less than a minute. But, up to that point, my publisher at the time, Warner Books, God bless them, hired a law firm to defend me and defend the book. Just going through all of the hassles of defeating a nuisance suit like that cost several thousand dollars. And that is, that's always a problem, and not just with true crime. I mean, it's a problem with any kind of nonfiction. At one point, I remember a suit a few years ago. I can't remember the details of it, but it was a female author who wrote a fictional account of a group therapy session in which she was involved, and she was sued by one of the people in the therapy session, and lost, lost in court, on grounds that, even though all the names had been changed and there was no indication that this was a real event, the jury agreed that somehow this plaintiff had suffered defamation at the hands of this fiction writer, and she wound up, being taboo for the next 20 years. Nobody would touch her in the publishing world because she had been successfully sued. So, it's always a risk, especially if you do write nonfiction, and especially if you delve into true crime, because there's all kinds of potential for people getting their feelings hurt, or assuming that they have somehow been damaged. But what you can't let that daunt you, though, and I think that Wambaugh would be the first one to agree. If you worried about the possibility of lawsuit, you'd never write anything, because every page you'd be second guessing yourself and going, "Oh well, I don't want to say that about so and so because they might go out and hire a lawyer and doom me, keep mm-hmm. me from ever writing again." That just that can't work. I mean, if you're afraid of lawsuits, then I would suggest that you become a plumber.
Well, you strike me in general as not being somebody who worries about what people think in general. I mean, I've interviewed you for articles, and you have been the most outspoken of anybody I think I've ever come in contact with. So yeah, I think the worry of what people will think carries over and stops a writer from writing the most benign works, even, because they're afraid of what the people they know are going to think about their writing.
Well, right. I mean, you know, that stops you. That stymies you. It's like stage fright. It's like standing up in front of a crowd and suddenly finding yourself without words. You lock up because what you're doing in your head is you're second guessing everything that you say, and therefore you say nothing at all. And you can't do that. I mean, if you're going to be a writer, then you know, the very first thing you have to do is write. So if you're you're sitting at the keyboard and you're going, oh, God, I don't know. I'm writing this story about a school teacher, and the school teacher, I'm saying the school teacher may not be writing as, or may not be instructing her kids in quite the way that she ought to, and that could be grounds for libel because I'm attacking her livelihood, and she could hire a lawyer from a Century City law firm and take away my house. You know, how much are you going to write? You know, not much. It's, you can't do that. You can't allow that to keep you from writing. And besides, you know, if you have a decent publisher, they're sharing the blame, in essence.
Mm-hmm.
The first person that someone's going to sue, if they're interested in money, is the publisher, not the writer, because writers are notoriously paupers.
Well, we have a minute left, and wonder if you could offer up any other advice for the writers who are listening, who may be slogging their way through a project and need some encouragement.
Sure. Two things. Always carry a pen and a pad of paper, no matter where you are, no matter what time of day it is. Always have a pen and a pad of paper, because you never know when a thought, an inspiration, an observation might hit, and it will go away unless you write it down. That's a very simple thing, but most people don't do that. I always do it. I always have a pen. I always have a pad of paper, no matter what. Number two, if you're going to be a writer, then write. And what that means is doing it every day. No matter what. Again, I mean, this is a matter of, this doesn't take, there's no magic to it. It's a matter of, you know, again, I quote that great philosopher, Woody Allen. 90% of success is showing up.
Yeah.
So get up, you know, figure out when the time of day is that you write best, or that you feel most comfortable with, and commit to it. And it doesn't have to be a lot. You can write as little as 10 or 15 minutes a day. You know, you could get up in the morning, have a cup of coffee, and get yourself an egg timer, sit in front of the computer until the egg timer goes off, and then that's it for the day. And maybe you write a sentence. Maybe you write a page. Some days, maybe you don't write anything at all. But you do it every day. And if you write a page a day, at the end of a year, you have a book.
Mm-hmm. That's right. That is so right. And it's been great hearing your voice again.
Well, it's good hearing yours.
Good to talk to you. And continued good luck on this book. And all of your work, and we all want that prolific gene. And I think you just mentioned how we can get the gene developing in ourselves by just putting yourself in the chair.
Yeah, that I'm not sure that's a gene, but...
Well, let's make it into one. Come on.
Uh-huh.
Cloning everything else.
Yes, I suppose it's the matter of... The prolific gene means parking the bottom that you have in those genes on a chair and actually getting the work done.
Yeah, that's it. Thanks, Dennis. Thanks so much for taking the time.
My pleasure. My pleasure. We'll have to do this in another 10 years.
I'll talk to you soon. That was Dennis McDougall talking to us from Los Angeles. If you want to know more about the show, please go to my website, which is penonfire.com. Email me from there if you want to be on the weekly email list. I'm going to leave you with a quote by Richard Bach, who said, "A professional writer is an amateur who didn't quit." Yeah. Thanks for listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM in Irvine. I'm Barbara DeMarco, author of Ben on Fire. I'll talk to you soon.